November 5th, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR, and it is 2 UTZ. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been busy doing a few repairs around the house. I did do some programming and exploring last week, compiling a few things, but still not a progressive project at this point. So we'll move down the list. Next on the list is Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. I have been out of town most of the last week in Chicago, but I did succeed in getting some satisfaction out of some of the magnetometer demo software I got from the manufacturer at long last. And
user joined your channel.
So now I have some data to compare against. I'm doing other things related to that, continue to, and try to get stuff together so somebody else can play with something as well. That's pretty much my world at the moment. Over to you.
Fine business. Sounds like a fun and productive week. Next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK, shown as recording, and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Then we have Nathan, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Hi, everyone. How are you? Things are going fine here at the University of Scranton. I've had a pretty good week. Most of what I have done for the project, I've been working with a few other students who've been doing some data analysis projects. So I've been coaching them on some ways to take a look at the ham radio data and visualize it a little bit better. We've also been working on continuing to set up the ham radio receive station at the university here. So that's moving along. We're ordering some filters to get rid of some interference. We are trying to get a little bit more space on the roof as well. And I also spoke with Troy and Frankie Bonte over email. And Frankie is one of the younger presenters from the HamSci workshop last year. And I think the plan is she's going to start working with Dave W. and take some of the hardware Dave KD0EAG is creating for the magnetometer, and she's going to help test that. So I see that, you know, I already heard Dave's report today, so thank you very much, Dave. And I see that Troy and Frankie are online tonight now, too, so hopefully they'll get to meet each other and chat a little channel. Bit. Okay, W2NAF, back to net.
Well, fine business, Nathan. And next on the list, we have Rob, AI6VN. And he just came on, so go ahead, Rob.
Good evening, everyone. My efforts are a little tangential to the Tangerine project, so I don't think that anything. But the one thing we did, we did manage, as I said we would do. Scotty and I had a talk with Dr. Fred Harris about utilizing his filter. Digital decimation filters in the Tangerine, and Fred sent us a tremendous number of, you know, half a dozen or more papers, and was, I thought, very cordial and supportive, and offered to, you know, mentor us through the process of editing it. But I don't think it's really Scotty's doing this. So that's been I think that was my most relevant effort. Relevant to this project, and I'll back to you guys.
Well, fine business, Rob, and thanks for doing that. Next on the list, we have Tom N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everybody on the list. Been a busy week. I've got the first draft of the receiver schematic input into the CAD tool, And I appreciate all the help from Scotty. I've been bombarding him with email questions all week and sent him a draft on Saturday to look at. And I haven't had a chance to go through his responses yet. That'll be later in this week. So that's it. Back to the group.
Well, next on the list, we have Troy and Frankie. Go ahead, either Troy or Frankie. Not sure if they figured out how to do the push to talk yet. Troy or Frankie, are you there? We'll go down the list and see if they come on later. Next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dave. And thanks for running the show again. Great job as usual. And I have been keeping an eye on the webpage too. And I see you created an audio channel and moved that telecon over there. So that is great. So we got more coverage of what's going on. Anyway, this week has been kind of mixed activities. We've spent a little bit of time on the protocol, but mostly have been getting ready for a talk that I have on Wednesday that I got roped into to the local radio club on Personal Space Weather Station. And but that'll be good. Get more word out to the local guys. And I had most of the presentation done already for the talk I gave to a different radio club here in the Valley in August. So it wasn't really too much work, but kind of moved out a little bit of Tangerine SDR stuff and moved in a little more Personal Space Weather Station stuff because I don't think they've been exposed to any of it. So it'd be good to show them why we're actually doing this. And then Tom said, I've been trying to help him on the schematic capture. And don't get too discouraged, Tom, when you look at what I sent you, because it's kind of different from what you sent me, but hopefully it makes sense, the changes that I made. So, and hopefully there weren't really changes in anything other than just formatting. And let's see, what else? There was something else that I was going to say. I think if maybe Nathaniel can answer if Troy and Frankie don't get back on, but were they the two young people that were at HamSci that that printed the wooden coins? And I think they both gave talks, if I remember right. But anyway, just a question to float for when we get to the general session. So back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And next on the list is Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, everyone. Well, this week I didn't really accomplish a lot. I did work for 2 or 3 hours with QJAC control, which is used to move audio, and I guess to some degree you can move INQ streams around Linux software or amongst Linux software. Kind of got that figured out. I'd actually used it maybe 6 or 7 years ago in a little bit earlier iteration, although quite frankly it's not changed all that much. Still having some issues with the N2 board and Lin HPSDR. It runs pretty well. It still has some clicks and pops here and there. And if you run the frame rate on the spectrum display more than about 2 or 3 frames per second, it kind of craps out. So I'm not sure what the issue is. It may be USB related. It might be something totally different. I'm not really sure right now. Doesn't seem like the CPU usage is really high, but it still isn't running as well as it could be from an audio standpoint. Anyway, that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. I'd be interested in knowing how to change some settings and see if I get the same results that you're getting. I'll try cranking up the frame rates and see. Okay, next on the list. That brings us to the end of the list of anybody. Oh, there's Dave, or David, N1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Okay, good. I'm really still trying to figure out how to drive this thing. I don't know why my microphone has a X on it and everybody else's doesn't. But the other thing that I'm curious about is why do I keep coming in on default channel and can't hear anybody until I get brought in? Is there a way to get straight in?
You can set a bookmark for the channel, and that's the way I usually do it. So the second item, there's bookmarks, and I can't tell you at the minute what exactly I put in my bookmark, but it jumps straight to the channel and doesn't put you in default first.
Okay.
Yeah, the other way you could do it, David.
Yep.
The other way you can do it is to just take your mouse and drag yourself down to the other channel after you come in.
It wasn't working.
Okay. Well, glad I drug you down here then.
Yeah, I was trying to drag myself in, but it just would keep popping back to default. But I just placed a bookmark, and we'll see if that, it shows Tapper TeamSpeak Surfer, but that's the general thing. I don't know if that's going to bring me into the Tangerine SDR discussion. But we'll see. This is an interesting thing here. Anyway, other than that, I don't have anything to report, but I wanted to sign on and see what the state of things was. So thank you.
Yeah, David, if you look down under the bookmarks, edit bookmarks, toward the bottom, there's a box that says default channel.
What do you mean edit bookmarks?
So you go to the menu, pull down the bookmarks menu.
Right.
And then you go to, under that, you go to edit bookmarks.
Oh,
and then you click on the one you want to edit, and then the screen that pops up, there'll be a box down there toward the bottom that says default channel.
And that should be Tangerine SDR.
Okay, there we go. That'll work. All right, thank you.
Okay, Dave, you want to see if Troy and Frankie got it fixed?
Yeah, Troy and Frankie, are you there? Can you speak? I guess not. Nathan can help them, or I don't know, but they can figure out how to get voice working and join us as they figure it out. It's always a learning exercise for each new person. But then we're at the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion.
Yeah, I'll start off. I will try emailing Troy and see what's up with that. I know when I first tried getting onto this, I had a hard time getting the audio just connected, so I don't even know if they can hear us, let alone talk. So I'll send them an email.
How about Troy and Frankie? Can you try typing something in the bar at the bottom of the screen and hit return and see if we see it? Ah, so you are hearing us. Good. Dave, which screen is it again that you set the PTT?
Tools, Options, Capture, and then there's the choice of what key you want to use for push to talk.
And it's best not to use the space key.
Yeah, don't use any keys that are repeating keys. To use Control, Function, Alt, or Shift, or something like that.
It can also be a problem when you do email at the same time you're doing TeamSpeak. you can end up with strange results.
You end up flashing your light when you're hitting keys that when you're not, because the PTT is active no matter what the focus of your screen is. So best to use a key like the right Alt key, which is not used for anything unless you're left-handed dyslexic.
Well, I guess that explains why I use the left Alt key.
Oh, you use the left one and not the right one?
Yeah, it's easier. For me, it's easier to get to because I'm right-handed, so I can write with my right hand, but then I want to do talk and write at the same time. I could use my left hand on the control key.
But you could talk and write at the same time. That's beyond my pay grade.
Well, it's stretching mine to the limit as well.
So while Troy and Frankie are trying to figure out the menus there, which are like Greek, Tom, I sent you an example of schematic that I tweaked up and used bus symbols on. And the key is that I edited the two parts, the ADC and the connector, to move some pins down and add some space so that you could put the bus connectors in without shorting things out.
Okay. Well, I think I averaged over 2 hours per wire trying to wire it up, unwire it, bus it, unbus it, rebus it, name it, unname it, change the bus name, and finally gave up on all of that. So I appreciate your help there.
Well, feel free to just grab that page one and paste it into yours, because I spent about 4 hours on it getting all the bus names and all that on there. But you really shouldn't use off-page connectors for on-page stuff. It probably will work, but just not a good idea, I don't think. I mean, it's one of those things where once you learn not to do it, you never try it again, so you never really realize whether it'll work or not, but it's just like a but don't do that. And then every signal should have a name on it, and not a bus, not a connector name, but a signal name. And of course, if you bus, then it automatically you're putting names on everything anyway, so it kind of works. But there's some restrictions on bus names. I thought, for instance, I could put the plus sign outside of the brackets, so it would be like D bracket 0 to 15, 0:15 bracket plus, and it will absolutely not let you do that. The last thing in the name has to be the number.
Yeah, I ran into a bunch of that. It doesn't handle differential signals at all. So I tried to set up a positive bus and a negative bus. The problem I ran into is I put the CMOS mode names on the library part pins and the LVDS names on the interconnect signals. And I was worried if I used the required names that the bus has, that anyone reading the schematic would have absolutely no clue what was going on.
Yeah, well, you have a note there, so that should help.
Yeah. Well, if so many folks read notes, I hate it when the tool forces you to use a name that makes sure the signal is not understandable.
Well, one of the things I suggested in my email was that I was going to redo the connector and split it into three pieces. You know, like a typical FPGA will have maybe 8 or 10 pieces because you can't possibly fit 684 pins on one page. So you break it up into smaller pieces, and then you get a U1A, a U1B, a U1C, like that. So I thought if we split the connector up into three pieces and then widen it out and put the actual pin name inside the connector, then that would be a very easy guide to make sure you didn't connect something up wrong.
Yeah, I hadn't figured out how to do multi-part components, and I was afraid to try and tackle that. At least I got the schematic in, got all the parts, and everything's wired up, and I'm printed it out. I'm going through and checking pin by pin to make sure I haven't goofed anything up. That's going to take probably a day to do. A couple of questions. Do we need any LEDs on the board?
That's a good question. What will we drive them with? One of your I2C converters?
Yeah, I've got a octal latch, and 6 of the outputs are driving relays, and I've got 2 spare outputs.
Yeah, I mean, if you got the spare outputs, I'd put LEDs on there, and they'll be able to be set with the command from the data engine, right?
Yes, exactly. I didn't know, you know, we had talked probably 3 or 4 months ago about having a green I'm good LED on every board.
Well, I was going to put that on the data engine at the connector so the data engine could say, I recognize what's plugged in there or I don't. But on the board would be good too, although each board is going to probably have a different way to talk to that pin, those LEDs.
Yeah. So at any rate, I can put 2 of them on there. I can put like a green and a red or 2 greens, whatever you think we ought to do. Second question, on CMOS device inputs that are connected to the connector, I put 1 megohm pull-down resistors just so that a static charge wouldn't go pop something. But in looking at most of the devices, they've got protection networks built in. I'm wondering if you think we need 1 megohm pull downs.
I don't need any on the DE because those pins to the FPGA are protected, but the probably wouldn't be a bad idea on to protect the ADC, although it's a lot of resistors. And you are using 0402s, right?
Yeah, almost all the parts are 402s. I've defined just a couple few bigger ones, but they're do not inserts. I just wanted more clearance. I just had the pull down so that the I2C devices would be protected. The ADC, I've got just a couple of 1 megohm pull downs on the input, connected from the antenna connector to ground so that they don't build up a static charge on the input capacitor.
I might offer some guidance.
Go ahead.
Even though the inputs are protected, you still want to have them asserted either to ground or to supply because a CMOS input draws a lot of current when it's floating in the middle.
Well, they will be pulled up or down once you plug the board in. because there's pull-ups on the FPGA pins. So even during reset time, they'll be terminated. But we're talking about when you're handling the board, right?
Right.
You don't want to get a static damage part.
Yeah. The I2C parts have internal, there's a multi-resistor network that'll assure they go to a logic zero if there's nothing connected.
Well, so there is already a leakage path?
Yeah. There's a couple of clamp diodes, and then there's a series protection resistor and another resistor to make sure it affirmatively goes to a logic zero.
Oh, okay. A lot of inputs don't have that.
Yeah. I put them on the antenna connectors. I put a couple of 1 megs. The reason is I have a DC blocking cap in series with the antenna connector to keep DC off of the filters internally. And so that cap, since somebody might hook it to a long wire antenna, I put a 1 meg to ground just to bleed off anything and prevent a big DC voltage. I've also got a clamp diode that's it's listed as 3, but it's guaranteed to turn on at more than 3 volts and less than 7 volts. So I've clamped the inputs with a big heavy protective clamp diode just in case. One other thing, I've got the filters listed on the schematic. Scotty, I couldn't find any 3-pin connectors in your library, so I used a 4-pin connector, but we're going to have to determine the size of that filter board since it's going to be plugged on top of the receiver.
Okay. One thing on the antenna input, did you take a look at the Hermes board? Because they use a special clamp diode that has extremely low capacitance, so it won't affect the input even at higher frequencies. So it might be worth looking at. I don't know what kind of diode you use. Maybe you use that particular one, but it's designed to do that particular task.
Yeah, that's exactly the diode that I've got on there.
Oh, okay. Good. And what was the other question again?
The filters. I've started working on designing high pass and band stop filters. And the band stop filter is challenging. It takes some big inductors to build the band stop, whereas a high pass filter gets away with quite a bit smaller inductors. And so I'm wondering if we have any size issues on the filter boards.
Well, how far apart can we make the connectors? Assuming that you want to put the connectors at the two ends of the filter board, we can make them far apart, but then we still have to have a path between them on the main board, right? Because you're going to have a resistor that you can pull off to replace the resistor on the RF board with the filter.
Yeah. So the right now I've got it set up, so if you don't want a filter, you have to plug in a blank filter board that provides the 50-ohm trace connecting the input to the output. And then you'll always have a filter board on there.
Okay, so we should either put 50-ohm traces underneath it with a jumper, or just put a 0402 resistor that you can pull off if you decide you want to use the filter board, because I don't want to have to provide a filter board to people who don't want one.
Okay, I'll make that change on that. I had, when I laid it out, I just laid out a required either a null filter board or required a particular one. I started looking at the inductors needed for a band stop filter, and some of the inductors are basically wound toroids on a surface mount package, and they stick up about 8 or 9 millimeters above the board.
Well, I don't think we'll have a height limitation if the board goes on top of the RF board, because we're going to put all the component side of the RF boards are going to be away from the data engine, with minimal to nothing on the back of the RF board, right?
Yeah, but parts sticking out tend to get hit, and I'm worried about them getting broken off the board.
Yeah, so if we make the board bigger, could you maybe lay them down?
No, the problem is finding the kind of inductors I can get. I'll keep searching. The other option is I can use a couple of smaller inductors in series. We'll probably want to ask Nathaniel and others whether a high-pass filter board is okay, or whether it actually needs to be a band stop type filter. I can design high-pass filters that use quite a bit smaller inductors than the band stop filter.
Well, what about if we were to make a provision to put like a can over it or something to protect, not for shielding near as much, as, although it would be good to have it shielded, but to, just to protect the components?
That's a possibility. I'm going to have to search through the, when you get over 20 microhenries, the selection of inductors available drops real quick.
Yeah, really. So, and the other thing is that it seems like, I don't know how you would do the filter physically, but suppose that the connectors that the filter plugged onto are too close together to put all the components in between them. Could you do some creative layout with the board and have the filters actually kind of loop around from one back to the other and not necessarily have to be within the envelope of the two connectors? And we'll have to make the board bigger, of course, but the limitation is going to be how far apart can you put the mating connectors on the RF
module.
User
disconnected from your channel.
Yeah. We can do things like that. My first objective was, how far apart do the pins have to go? Because the pins all have to sit over the analog portion of the ground plane. And because there's a lot of layout issues where you don't want overlapping planes and things like that. So I'll have to. I'm going to have to spend some time designing the filters before we know what would fit. The key question is if we can use a high pass filter instead of a band stop, I think we can make it smaller.
The only problem with the high pass is if you have inputs that are above your Nyquist frequency, then you don't stop them out.
Well, but there's a 50 meg filter already on the board, wired in permanently. This is just the filter like for an AM broadcast band stop filter, or instead of, we could have a stop that stopped from 0.5 to 1.8 megahertz, or we could have a high pass that knocked down everything below 1.8 megahertz.
Okay, and I think that would work as long as, if you're knocking everything down below 1.8 megahertz, then unless you really wanted to listen to beacons or VLF or something, that would be okay.
Yeah, so the question is, do you need beacons and VLF simultaneously with HF? So a band stop filter would knock down the AM, but allow you to simultaneously listen below the AM band and above the AM band. Whereas a high pass filter says that, you just knock down everything below 1.8. So the question would be, is there a requirement to simultaneously listen below and above AM at the same time?
So what do you think, Nathaniel?
So I think it would be desirable to... So I guess you probably know my approach so far is I'm going to take everything you can give me. So if I can have the ability to listen to both VLF and HF simultaneously, I think that's highly desirable. I know there's a lot of very important VLF science out there to be done. The question then becomes, is that affordable? In terms of space with the receiver layout and in terms of the parts cost? And if we wanted to do VLF science, is it better to have a separate board or a separate unit for that?
Yeah, well, if you wanted to do VLF, you would have a couple of options. If you didn't need to knock out the AM band, then you don't have to worry about the filter at all. You could put a low pass, which passed just the VLF bands and took everything else out. So there's a bunch of options. I'll continue to study. I'm just trying to figure out how to fit a band stop filter, which requires some pretty high Q components on it in the available space.
If I may interject here, I have some experience with those at KPH and elsewhere. New Select makes a band stop filter that they sell. It's remarkably small and remarkably effective and optimized down at 500 kilohertz and 6 dB down about 1.7 megahertz. And it works perfectly at KPH and remarkably small, size of your thumbnail. I'm not sure that it requires all that large that much space to put in an effective band fan-stop filter. At least it works for me. You know, I've been able to get rid of the AM, and I don't think you can listen to, you know, you can't listen to anything without a band stop for your AM if you're anywhere near 100 miles of a...
See, Rob, can you put the URL down below?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I went and looked. Mini Circuits doesn't have any kind of filters like that at all. I looked through their catalog.
This is a little marvel. I just found it recently. One of my colleagues built a custom designed one for us, and it's small too. But now that I found the news elect, it's $10, and now it's SMA in and out. Let's see here. So not exactly, but you could lay out a little card. Let's see if you guys see that link?
Yeah, I saw the link. I'm opening. I've got it. Okay, I see it. Yeah, it's small. Looks like it could be. You could just unsolder the connectors and modify it to easily work.
There are other similar. There's high. I was using a high pass, but at this point, this thing is really so well optimized that even the custom designed eight elements filters, I think, are that we've built have been kind of overkill. This thing is good enough to. I've got a AM station at 1640 that's comes in at probably 0 dBm off of our antenna, and this thing is enough to squash it down by 30 dB. I can still get 160 meter whisper spots. They're down a bit, but not much.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things I have as thoughts. One is that probably do want to have a exclusive low pass for VLF work that cuts AM and above out. Another question is, are we able to individually select filters on different channels, or do they all get selected if we've got multiple channels the same? Do we have to run the same filters on each channel?
No, I've got it set up so there's connectors on the two channels, and you can plug different filters on the two channels.
But they're pluggable filters, and then there's a different set of pluggable filters on the other RF board. So you have a filter for each channel, right? Right, Tom?
Yeah, that's right. Each channel has got its own pluggable filter.
Yep. So it may be that the simplest thing to do would be to have a high pass for HF and above and a low pass for VLF, each of which that would cut out AM. And, I'm used to putting an external band stop if I need it. Like this one that Nolex got. That's a nice little compact one. We've used ones that are BNC or even UHF connectors in the past.
Yeah, I don't know. The key is, the inductors. I was just looking through DigiKey and I was not able to find, any inductor that I could find that had enough inductance was bigger than that package on the link.
And you could still use an external one if you wanted to just hook that up with SMAs.
Right.
That is a really nice little filter.
Someone might get one and take a look inside.
Yeah, you can pop the can open. You can pop the can open and take a look inside. I haven't looked very closely at it.
We clearly found some nice, small, high-value inductors for that.
Yeah, so far I haven't seen any saturation of the filter, so they don't seem to introduce any nonlinearities into the receiver.
Yeah, it was just... I had a hard time finding any inductors in the size range of any kind. Maybe DigiKey is just not the right place to look for RF inductors.
Did you look on Coilcraft?
No, I just looked at DigiKey this afternoon.
Okay. Yeah, another thing that you might try is a place called ECIA Authorized. It's a clearinghouse of about a dozen companies. So you might find parts there without having to go plunk through a whole bunch of different websites.
So that was ECI-authorized?
Yeah, I'll put the link down here.
Okay, well, I'm still studying the kind of filters available and parts. I just started looking at that this afternoon.
User in your channel timed out.
Scotty, I wanted to mention, somebody came in that was had a name on their sign, Tapper, and did not identify themselves, but I'm not sure who that was. And I do have some website changes that you didn't mention. John Ackerman's GPS talk is up on the link of videos now. That's the only full-length one that's been put up on Ham Radio 2.0 to this point.
Okay, yeah, because see, that was the first one up on Friday, so he's probably going to try to do them in order.
Yep. So they'll be coming, but he's been doing other videos in between.
Okay, well, very good. I think Troy and Frankie want to try it again here. So let's see if they got it working. Not looking promising. We don't see the light. So if you go to Tools, menu at the top, and then pick Options at the very bottom, and then when the screen comes up, you click on the Capture tab, you should get the configuration screen for the capture. And at about the third line down is a push to talk button. You have to check that radio button so that it turns on, and then you get to pick the hotkey with the default's the right alt, which is the alt key that's just to the right of the space bar.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be working for us. I switched it over to the voice activated mode. Can you hear us now?
Yep, that works great.
Okay. Well, we'll be sure to pause it or mute it. But anyway, this is Troy AC at XP, and Frankie's with me. She's got a little sandwich going on right now. But anyway, we just wanted to thanks for being added to the group. And Dr. Frizzell, thank you for asking us to join in. And we're really looking forward to being on the citizen side of this project.
Well, very good. Very welcome to the crew. Glad you're here. Sorry, Nathaniel.
That's okay. We doubled. I was just going to say we're very glad that you're here, and we're glad you could join in.
Good.
Yep. Same comment from me.
Do you have any questions, Troy? You might want to chat with Dave KD0EAG. He is the person that I thought you and Frankie might work with a bit.
It sounds great. We've been looking at the information that you that you sent over on project summary. So that's been good. We've also seen a few of the videos on YouTube, and just trying to understand what's happening. What I think, you know, we could do is certainly help with some possible locations. I work for a small university. Frankie's high school might be interested in this, and you know, we're able to pull together whatever resources that you need. I'm sure there will be questions, but not yet. Frankie, do you have anything to say or add, or
nothing really to add?
I think that all sounds good over here. Dave, KD0EAG, I know you sent me an email earlier today. Did you have anything you wanted to say?
Only that I tried to send my direct email address to Troy and Frankie there, and they might have seen it. I don't know what the OSX interface looks like, but it was in if they double-click, it should have popped up a tab at the bottom of the screen. I can send it again if they'd like to communicate with me for any reason directly. Otherwise, I'd be happy to work with you, see what your interests are and what your capabilities are, you know, what level you'd like to tackle things at, and try to make something that would work well for you. I appreciate your interest.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. We'll look for the email address, and we'll make sure that we make comment. So, someone asked if the kids were the ones that put together those little wooden buttons, and yes, that is was Frankie and Seamus, and I imagine that Seamus KEAGTT will be involved as well.
All right. Well, thank Frankie for those, because I still have those. They're pretty cool.
Oh, good.
One other thing I wanted to note, I mentioned this to Scotty, but other people too. I did post a blog post on hamside.org showing the videos of Scotty showing off the Tangerine SDR mockup. So if anyone has any news items that they'd like to see on hamside.org, if I don't think of it myself, please feel free to send me a note and prompt me, and I can add some things to hamsci.org as well.
Oh, Dan, I took the setup, and in fact, I'm not sure I told you this. I brought my lithium ion big backup battery, lithium iron LIFEPO4 battery, and I bought a 13-inch DC powered screen, and I got the whole VIM3 SDR setup running on battery.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's pretty good. I actually want to buy a VIM3 board this week.
Yeah, and I haven't run the Odroid on it because the Odroid requires 12 volts, but the VIM3 will run off of a USB-C connection. So I have the battery pack, which has a 2 cigarette lighter plug receptacles in the front. So I plug in a USB-C, USB-3 adapter. I run the VIM3 off the USB-C. I run the display power off the USB-3, the regular USB Type-A. And then there's a direct power pull battery connection that comes off the side to run the IQ2. And I can run the whole thing off of the battery for, it draws about 1.6 amps from the 12-volt battery, and it's a 9.6 amp-hour battery. So you can figure I might get 5 to 6 hours of playtime out of it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty nice. I have actually, I think I told you last week, I've been looking for a battery to use with the IQ2 and a single board computer.
How much money do you have?
Yeah, I've got about $8 or $9. Will that cover it?
AA is your best bet. No, I use the green batteries, and I forget the name of the outfit. I can go figure it out. I can go look at my battery and tell you. But the LIFEPO4s are a replacement for lead acid batteries, so they have a similar voltage curve, and so you can you don't get like either 11 or 15 volts. You get 12 to 14. But they're pricey, so a battery will cost you maybe $80.
Yeah, I could probably afford that. I did have a question anyway. I'll think of it in a second.
I have a couple of the batteries from BioNO that are being marketed. I think they're the green batteries that are they're promoting a lot to hams, and they seem like quality products. And they're the lithium iron phosphate batteries.
Yep, those are the ones, Dave.
So do they charge with a trickle charge, or do you have to get a special charger?
They have a little charger that you buy additionally, which I didn't do initially. I don't know how it is different from others, but it's not very expensive. It's like maybe another $10, something like that.
I actually have a, I think it's a adaptable to a LIFEPO4 charger, or a charger that works with that battery. So, good look at.
Yeah, I bought a Tanergy LIFEPO4 charger at Fry's for like $19. And I think it charges at between 1 and 2 amps. So it's not really a killer. But then the battery is only 9.6 amp hours. So probably don't want to charge it too fast.
Yeah, true, although this can probably take a pretty good charge.
Yeah, especially at the beginning, you can ramp them up pretty fast. But what I found was one of those power bank things at the flea market. It has a handle on the top, and it's meant to have use a 7-amp-hour gel cell, like a lead-acid type battery. And the LIFEPO4 battery drops right in there. I mean, you can pick those up for almost nothing at flea markets with dead batteries in them, which is what I did. And the battery fits right in. I ground the side out, one of those little metal plates with two power poles on it to bring power directly out from the battery, and use the two cigarette lighter plugs to bring power again directly out of the battery. And then it has a 3, 6, and 9 volt regulator in it, switchable, that you can use to power lower voltage items with a barrel connector. So it's a pretty slick deal for, the few bucks I paid.
Yeah, believe it or not, I just came across a USB, like a double USB cigarette plug deal a couple days ago. I brought it with me for some reason.
Yeah, if you're going to run the VIM3, you need one that has a USB-C charge port on it.
Yeah, I actually have a couple of USB plugs that have the USB-C charge ports.
Yeah, mine has the USB-C and I believe two USB 2.0s, which are 2.4 amps, and then it's got a QC 3.0 high current, high voltage charge port, which also works as a regular USB. So it's got three Type A's and a Type C connector on it, and a metal housing. I forget the name brand, but it's one of the name brand ones. I bought it on Amazon, I think.
The batteries and the microprocessors don't seem to cost much of anything anymore. It's just the keeping up with the USB connectors that you need that keeps me broke.
Yeah. So Dave, that Bi-Eno or Bi-Eno, a 9.6 amp hour battery, what can you guess what it costs?
I remember it was under $100, or there just right. It might have been as low as 80. I'm pretty certain that's the one I have too. The prices kind of have been drifting downwards, certainly have on all that stuff generally, but I'm not dead certain. But it's Bi-Eno, I think. Bi-Eno, as I recall. I'll look it up.
Yeah, I know I got a couple of those at the flea market local here. They had a bunch of poles, and I bought two of them for, I think, $15 a piece. And one of them was bad, so I got a $30 battery.
I added the link down below.
Scotty, I found Coilcraft has inductors in a reasonable size.
Oh, okay. So you think you can make something about the size of the little guy there that the link was brought?
Yeah, I have no idea the price. Coilcraft doesn't have the price on their website.
Yeah, you got to dig down, and you can get free, like up to, I think, 5 or 10 free samples. But if you dig down, I think you can find the prices.
Okay, I'll try digging down. I tried to get data on the part, and it said, how many do you want to order?
Yeah, their website's not very easy to use, but the stuff's there if you dig down deep enough.
They're pretty friendly to deal with, too.
Okay, well, they were 3x5 millimeters in size, so those are reasonable size parts.
Well, so here you go, Dan. 12 volts, 9 amp hour LFP battery, $100.
Okay, sounds good. I actually see on the link that Dave put up, battery looks like it's on the instrument panel of an airplane, although I would say that an installation like that's probably pretty illegal.
What, like Velcroed to the dash so when you crash it hits you in the forehead?
Yeah, I think it's actually stuck into like a little cutout on the instrument panel. That's, I think batteries that you put in airplanes like that have to be TSO'd, which requires a whole lot of testing and stuff.
Yeah, I ended up getting a LIFE PO4 battery at the flea market in Tucson about a year ago. It's a 36 amp hour one, I think. It's the size of a motorcycle battery, a large motorcycle battery. And it's got overvoltage, overcurrent, undercurrent. It's got the whole protector equalizer board built in the top in the transparent compartment.
Oh, sounds nice. Yeah, I know that a lot of people who do solar cell charging on boats and other places use LFP batteries.
Yeah, and this one was $100, which is kind of a lot for a used battery. But I went online and looked, and you could buy a new one. It's like $700. It's just, for the big ones, it's ridiculous, the prices. But they have, I think they're rated for like 3,000 charge-discharge cycles, so they have pretty good longevity.
Yeah, I think they're deep cycle, just equivalent to deep cycle lead acid.
They really hold their charge when they're just sitting around, too, which is nice, for me at least.
The thing irritating about this 36 amp hour battery is the board, the control board that's on the top behind a plexiglass cover, it has a green LED that constantly flashes all the time. You can't turn it off. So you set it in the ham shack and you think like the killer robots come in to get you because it's flashing on the ceiling at night.
Well, Scotty, we're coming up on our hour, and I overstayed my time last week, so I'm going to take out a lead at this point. So 73.
Hey, 73, Dave. Thanks again.
User disconnected from your channel.
And I guess unless anyone has anything else, we're ready to QRT here. We usually try to hold it to about an hour, and we're pushing right up against that. So anything else?
Thanks for the all the sources of supply on parts, Scotty.
Okay, well, hope it helps. You being the leader of the hardware board is the first one to be actually working on a real board.
It's only paper right now.
So I used to tell my customers, well, I still tell them, what you buy from us is paper, because if we can't tell you how to build 1,000 of them, then we didn't do our job, and that's contained in the paper.
Quick question, what version of ORCAD are you using?
9.2.
Okay, just curious.
If you're interested, I'll send you an email.
Okay, my brother's always used ORCAD, and I've heard a litany of stories about it over the years, but he started in the very early days, so I'd be interested.
Yeah, I started with like release one, and they've changed the schematic format, the digital format, the binary coding of it, at least three times since I've been using ORCAD. But I'd say it's usable enough. I mean, it's got its quirks.
They all do.
But as long as we can interface to our CAD guy and turn out boards that work, all the fancy things are, you know, it's like buying an FT1000 versus buying a KX2.
Yeah, and the learning curve on any of them is immense, so you kind of have to stick with what you know.
Yeah, and you know, I figured we're using 9.2, and they're up to like 19 or 20, maybe in the 20s even. And when they were at like revision 19 or 18, I decided I probably ought to re-up our version and get the modern one. And I did. And it's so different that I don't even use it, because I have to do a whole bunch of learning over again. I'm going like, I'm fast with the old one. It does everything I need. So basically, I fire up the new one when I have to convert the program back to the previous 9.2 version from the later format version, which changed about 16.2. So any of the new versions, I have to open in the new tool, check a box, write it out in the old format, and then I can open it in the old 9.2 and edit it.
Yeah, I guess I was asking because I'm using KiCad for what I'm doing. It's simple stuff. And I noticed an export to ORCAD 2, something like that format option, but I don't know that that's of any use for anything.
Can you output to PADS format?
It may be able to. They keep. They've been moving pretty fast with it because the CERN people use it and seem to be behind a lot of the development. So I think maybe PADS was in there.
Yes, PADS is an industry standard. It's a big name, like probably bigger than ORCAD. Anyway, if you can export it in PADS, then our CAD guy can do the professional layout of it when we get to that point, unless you want to do it, in which case you can do it.
It's not that I terribly, so much want to do any of these things, any given thing myself. I'd happily leave it to someone who knew what they were doing. But a lot of the efforts in designing designing the components and actually getting used to their terminology.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because I just as soon let the layout guys do the layout, because they're really proficient at it. And not to say that you and I couldn't do it, but we would be slower and we'd run into pitfalls that the professional guys won't. So I usually let them do it. And like you said, concentrate on the functionality of it and let someone else who's a professional at it worry about making it a physical layout of it.
Yeah, I'd like to get something as simple as what I'm doing is. I'd like to get something together as quickly as I can, but I run into occasional frustrations.
Well, for only a few, you can just hand wire them, right?
It depends on what exactly I want to hand wire on there. The fact that the way the 5-volt comes down, it's a little hard to get. It's not hard, but I have to almost blue wire using to bring a 5-volt, and there's not an obvious place to put a voltage regulator, an LDO, once I do that. But I'm sure I
can. Oh, well, I have faith. You can do it.
I probably have to go on here now myself, so It's good talking to you, Troy and Frankie. Don't hesitate to get in touch with me, and I'd be happy to know what I can do for anybody. Take care. 73 all.
73 Dave, thanks so much.
Yeah, 73 Dave.
Well, Scotty, take care. I will send you a revised schematic sometime this week. User disconnected from your
channel. Okay, and if you want me to build that connector, the more I think about it, the better that'll make the schematic look, because it'll just help reduce the possibility that we connected up a pin wrong. Or what will happen is we'll look at the connector and we'll say, oh, wait, that's not right, and then we'll fix it.
Yeah, I had to reassign several pins on the connector.
Oh, okay. So good. This will be a good way to do it then. I'm probably not going to get to it till later in the week, because I really have to get the QEX article and the PSR articles out. They're going to string me up.
Okay. Quick question. Can you send me a copy of the program you're doing for your ham club? Because I'm doing one for the ham club on Thursday on personal space weather.
Oh, sure. I can do that. Can I upload to your Dropbox?
I didn't send you a writable link. Let me do that.
Okay. That's the best way, because it's huge. It's got fancy pictures. In fact, I stole half the stuff from Nathaniel's presentation.
Okay. Well, I went
and I just gave an updated presentation at the University of Scranton this week. So if you want me to send you the slides, I'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, that's fine. I put it together from the HamSci, and then I borrowed Jason's video of Scotty describing the unit and some of the TID displays, the one done in Japan. And I think you had a couple of better ones.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you so much.
I'd like to see that too, Nathaniel. My talk is on Wednesday, so I don't know how you can get it to me. Is it up online, or is this brand new, right?
Yeah, it's brand new. I'll just send you the Google. I'll send you a Google Drive link to the slides.
Okay, sounds good. Great, and I will. And if I can write that Google Drive, I'll put my presentation up there if you want. Although the slides I took from your presentation, I left formatted the way you had it, so it still has HamSci and NJIT and all that on the footer there, so it's identifiable.
Oh, okay, thanks. So actually, we want to change NJIT to see now University of Scranton, but we'll see how that goes.
Okay, can you send me that logo? I'll swap it out.
Sure, I will be glad to. Actually, what I did with my new slides is I just removed the logo, and I just had my email address that says Scranton. But because I didn't have enough time to get the logo to look good, but I will send you what I have.
Okay, anything, because all I'm going to do is put it on the master slide and shrink it down so it fits in the lower corner.
Okay, that sounds great.
Hey, thanks again, everyone, for letting us listen in tonight. We'll figure out our keyboard problems. I think it's a keyboard issue and not necessarily a TeamSpeak issue, but look forward to following your lead. So
yeah, thank you so much for letting me listen in.
Well, thank you for coming, Frankie and Troy. We're really glad to have you.